Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of President Obama's national security team and assess the concern that is often that an often disengaged president is surrounded by ex-congressional staffers and academics who lack real-world experience and that he does not get the counsel of seasoned diplomats, intelligence veterans, and statesmen. Roger Morris, who served on the senior staff of the National Security Council under Presidents Johnson and Nixon and is the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan and the Politics of Intervention, and Kindred Rivals, America, Russia and Their Failed Ideals, joins us to discuss foreign policy amateurism in the White House at a time of international crises. Then we will speak with Kate Gould, the Legislative Associate for the Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby that fields the largest team of registered peace lobbyists on Capitol Hill. She lobbies for Israel-Palestine peace, and we will discuss her article in the Huffington Post, Five Steps U.S. Can Take to Help Restore Israel-Gaza Ceasefire, and whether the latest war in Gaza is shifting attitudes in Congress, where unconditional support for Israel has been the norm for decades. Then finally, we'll examine the efforts by Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Texas Congressman Pete Sessions to scuttle House Speaker Boehner's immigration bill on the last day before Congress adjourns for the summer recess. Wayne Slater, the senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, joins us to discuss the political posturing of Texas Governor Rick Perry and junior Senator Ted Cruz, both of whom are running for the Republican presidential nomination in 2016 and are trying to get the attention of Christian conservative voters who dominate the Republican primary process. And joining us now is Roger Morris, who served in the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He is the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention. And his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Morris.
Thank you, Ian.
And yesterday I spoke with Dr. Stephen Cohen, who is something of an outlier in terms of being not so much supportive of Russia's position in this conflict with Ukraine, but critical of the almost overwhelming U.S. position, which has been demonizing Russia, praising Ukraine, and unquestionably calling for a tougher stance. And it seems to me that there's very few voices anywhere that are cautioning in terms of how dangerous this situation is, that we could be well on the brink of a war in Ukraine. And as these incremental steps in this confrontation continue, you do feel that there is the need for some kind of statesmanship to intervene. It seems to me that the hawks on both sides are in the ascendancy and are driving the agenda.
I think that's very much true. I should say at the outset that I have enormous respect for Stephen Cohen. I think he's one of the preeminent, if not the most preeminent, American scholar of Russia and of the Soviet Union, not just the post-Soviet period, but the earlier Soviet period as well. So I think we should take his remarks, which I saw on your website, very, very seriously indeed. The truth of the matter, Ian, is that there is no one around Barack Obama, no one certainly in the inner circle of foreign policy advisors in this administration, who really knows what they're dealing with in terms of Putin and Putin's Russia, for that matter, for the Ukraine or Eastern Europe. This is very much the amateur hour, as you indicated in your opening remarks. I think that traces back to the very inception of the Obama campaign, when he was looking for foreign policy advisors, and this was, after all, a rather unformed politician who was skillful at domestic campaigning and knew something about some domestic issues, but who was largely a blank slate in foreign policy. He was staffed by the former Indiana congressman and chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Lee Hamilton. That's where Ben Rhodes and Dennis McDonough come from, the chief speechwriter for the National Security Council. And Rhodes is very much the force behind much of what Obama says in public about this issue. Dennis McDonough, the White House chief of staff, was formerly the deputy NSC advisor under Tom Donilon. The other foreign policy legacy, of course, came from the Clinton administration without much distinction as well. Tom Donilon, who was a Clinton hangover, and now his successor, Susan Rice, by way of Brookings and the Clinton administration. These are people without intellectual candle power. They are very much Washington bureaucrats, beltway hangers-on, courtiers, if you will. And Obama has not reached beyond them. I think that's the most discouraging and alarming thing about all of this. He doesn't seem to be able to come out of the cocoon of comfortable and familiar advisors around him, regardless of what they know. I think he prides himself very much on a mastery of these matters, and at the same time, one has to look at the personality of a president. We know now, it's really amazing, we're still trying to decipher the meaning of some of the Nixon tapes and some of the Lyndon Johnson tapes and so on. We're still learning about the impact of personality and temperament on foreign policy, which is, of course, decisive, often enormous. And this president has a history not just of being a good speechmaker and a fashionable symbolic figure in American politics, but of being very much the outsider, very much absent as well as present in these policy deliberations. He has ceded more authority in foreign affairs than any recent president, I suspect, even including George W. Bush, when that story comes to be told. Bush, I think, saved us from catastrophe in his second term by literally supplanting the absolute dominance of Dick Cheney as vice president and the neocons who had so dominated the first administration. Obama has done this not just in the White House, not just with a lackluster and comfortable NSC staff, but also, of course, with the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of State, the Pentagon, institutions where presidents have to reach in and establish their grip, establish their imprint, establish their writ in order to make as well as execute foreign policy. So I think we're in rather deep trouble here in terms of any kind of creative or conciliatory resolution of the problem in the Ukraine. That would have to start not only with statesmanship at home, but also an understanding, of course, of what we're dealing with on the ground in Eastern Europe and in Russia.
Well, Roger Morris, what troubles me so much about this is that one of the greatest achievements in modern political history was the end of the Cold War. The fact that for decades we lived within 30 minutes of extinction across the globe, and this was a constant situation, a hair trigger, and we survived, and thanks to Reagan and Gorbachev winding it down, and now somewhat blithely it's come back, this Cold War, and now you have a situation where you may even have a hot war on the border with Ukraine and Russia.
It's come back. It's come back in large measure, not only because of Obama, of course, but also because of the policies of the Clinton administration and George W. Bush. Obama has very largely continued those policies, oblivious to what we should have known were longstanding and permanent Russian concerns about their own security, about their own dignity, about the importance of the states on their immediate frontier, the near foreign. You know, I think that the more we learn, Ian, about the end of the Cold War, the more credit goes for good and for ill to Mikhail Gorbachev, who did make the moves that led to the disintegration of the Soviet Union and who did take the initiative very largely with both Reagan and with George H.W. Bush to defuse the Cold War. He's the one who made the fateful decisions, from Soviet point of view, the fateful decisions not to use armed force to keep the Poles in line, or to hold on to the empire in Eastern Europe or in the Caucasus. These were decisions made in the Kremlin as much as the result of anything done or not done in Washington. And then after that bit of, I would call it, very fortunate statesmanship in international terms, from our point of view, we, of course, forfeited entirely, blundered entirely, with any effort to bring the post-Soviet Russia into the comedy of nations, to integrate it into a new and more stable and peaceful Europe, as it should have been. Instead, we pushed the old NATO alliance, as you know, right up to the old borders, the old Curzon line, and the most insecure frontier for a Russia which has suffered so mightily from invasions from Western Europe. And that is a blunder in world politics for which I'm afraid we will pay well beyond Vladimir Putin. I mean, Putin is may be a thug in many ways and a loose cannon, but he is the expression of something very fundamental and long run in Russian mentality.
And there are worse people to the right of him, you know. I mean,
absolutely.
That's one of the...
They're always lurking there. The great Russian chauvinists have always been present in the Kremlin, present under Gorbachev, and certainly under Yeltsin, and now under Putin. I see no sensitivity to any of these politics in the White House, and certainly not in Washington. When you cast about for a resolution of this, some kind of, it seems to me we've got a dysfunctional White House in foreign policy, and it badly needs an intervention, as it were. But when you cast about for an intervention, you can't find the responsible adults here, the responsible party in the Congress, on Capitol Hill, in the Democratic Party. I think that most progressive critics of the political scene have failed miserably to really look seriously at the failures of Obama's foreign policy and at the people who are at the heart of that. They're very, very soft on Susan Rice and Samantha Power and the other people who have driven this agenda. And of course, most of all, they're soft on the President of the United States, whose record in foreign policy, I think, is going to be his undoing in terms of historical legacy. Now, there are lots and lots of important things going on, as you know, besides the Ukraine. The negotiations continue with Iran. There certainly are very, very serious issues in Gaza and in the rest of the Middle East. You've got the collapse, in effect, of the Iraqi state. He's facing multiple crises. If ever there was the need for professionalism, ever the need to reach out to a grand assembly of expertise in the United States across the aisle as necessary, there are some wise heads still left in the Republican Party. They're not in office right now, but they're there. This man ought to be convening the wise men of American foreign policy in the White House to advise him and to chart a course away from the very dangerous confrontation. We're facing a power in the Ukraine that has the capacity to destroy us and to destroy much of the world with us. We really haven't really faced that possibility since the 1980s. And I think Americans, certainly the newer generation of younger Americans who have not lived under the Cold War, must come to grips with just how grim that prospect is.
And, of course, Roger Morris, in terms of the Republican Party, the alternative to President Obama would have been John McCain, and by now John McCain would have us in a war in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, and in Ukraine.
So, well, absolutely, but I think, you know, I think one of the problems here is the usual lesser of evils trap that progressives fall into in looking at the failures of their own party, whether it's a Clinton or an Obama, or the future of Hillary Clinton here, who stands to be, I think, arguably even worse than Obama in some of these matters. It hardly matters, it seems to me, what John McCain or the hawks, the neocons, would be doing now. They don't even deserve serious attention in terms of the foreign policy dialogue. We're facing here a national and international crisis in which the United States has got to muster the very best, the very wisest policy, observing its own national interests, but also the future of Europe, the future of the world, really, in terms of the possibility of an American-Russian confrontation. There's no time to dwell on how much better Barack Obama is than John McCain. That goes without saying. But once you've survived a bad sore throat and you're faced with cancer, you really have to deal with the crisis at hand. And that I'm afraid is where we are.
Well, apparently the president sort of pretty much outsourced Israel and to Kerry, and I don't think, you know, Obama can stand Netanyahu. Not that most American presidents could stand this guy. He's apparently quite odious to have to deal with, and he's also apparently outsourced Russia to Biden because he can't stand Putin. But I understand that Henry Kissinger and people like, and even Zbigniew Brzezinski, who's a Democrat, are not being listened to at the moment, or they can't get past the bubble of these lightweights surrounding Obama.
And I think this is a relatively new and very disturbing development. I heard from a lot of people that Obama was reasonably open during the first term. Not that it altered policy all that much, but at least he was listening to people from the outside, sitting down with scholars and critics and so on, and with former diplomats. That's not true anymore. I think he's become very closed off and as you said earlier, very absentee, very distracted and refracted in these foreign policy matters. He's trusting people who do not deserve and cannot really execute the trust that he's placing in them. I just think again that this is not an abstract or distant sort of third world foreign policy issue. This is our old and great adversary in the world, who still has the capacity to bring about a Holocaust. And there's no other problem like it. The Chinese are not really in that category. Certainly not any nation in the Middle East or in Asia. These problems are unprecedented and without parallel. And yet we're bringing to them an administration which is arguably of unprecedented isolation and lack of intellectual candle power and professionalism in foreign affairs.
Well, Roger Morris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the United States Foreign Service and on the senior staff of the National Security Council under both Presidents Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon until resigning over the invasion of Cambodia. He's the author of Between the Graves, America, Afghanistan, and the Politics of Intervention, and his latest book is Kindred Rivals, America, Russia, and Their Failed Ideals. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a lobbyist for Israel-Palestinian peace on Capitol Hill.
from Russia with love. I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Kate Gould, who is the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestine peace and has an article at the Huffington Post, Five Steps U.S. Can Take to Help Restore Israel-Gaza Ceasefire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kate Gould.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
Well, it's good to talk to you, Kate, and you must have your work cut out on Capitol Hill trying to bring about Israel-Palestine peace, particularly what's been happening in the last couple of days. There's been some hideous incidents in Gaza with a UN-run school that was shelled, and this is prompted over 106 people were killed on Wednesday in Gaza. And there was also a shelling of a market near Gaza City, which killed 17. The death toll so far is 1,336, mostly civilians on the Palestinian side, and 58 Israelis, 56 of whom are soldiers on the Israel side. And, of course, condemnation from, as I mentioned, from Ban Ki-moon and condemnation from the U.S. side, but without actually mentioning Israel. So on Capitol Hill, what's the mood?
Certainly a very dark time on Middle East policy. We have seen first, I mean, the news certainly is grim that, well, everything that's happening in Gaza. And then on Capitol Hill, we have seen both the House and the Senate pass resolutions, pass voice vote in support of Israel's attacks on Gaza. But at the same time, I will say, and I've, you know, watching this issue over the years, there is something different about this time. And it seems like the public opposition to Israel's attacks on Gaza is starting to pierce through, you know, the halls of Congress. I mean, at the beginning of this escalation, I heard from congressional staff that they were hearing overwhelmingly from those who were opposed to any kind of ceasefire agreement, opposed to the U.S. pushing for a ceasefire that would end violence on all sides. And then just today I heard about a office where they've been receiving just overwhelmed with calls, and they've 50-to-1 ratio actually opposed to these continuing attacks and calling for a ceasefire agreement. So we've even seen some pretty substantial changes just in these last few days and over these very, very dark weeks. We have also seen that there have been, you know, some members of Congress who've come out on the floor, given impassioned speeches in support of a ceasefire agreement. You know, of course, these are few compared with those who are giving speeches green-lighting further attacks on Gaza. But it's something to note. It's important that there was a letter from six members of Congress led by Congressman Keith Ellison, who had an op-ed calling for a ceasefire and lifting the blockade. It was published in the Washington Post just today. And then he led this group of six members of Congress calling on Kerry to continue these efforts to push for a ceasefire. And then we saw a number of other members of Congress give speeches noting this devastating loss of lives and highlighting the Israeli loss of life and also Palestinian. At the same time, you know, it's clearly a very fraught issue, and today the House actually passed a resolution condemning Hamas for using civilian shields and giving the impression that all of the civilians killed in Gaza are result from Hamas's actions. So there's, of course, no responsibility put on Israel's part, Israel's attacks on Gaza causing these casualties, and no mention of the fact that that a ceasefire would be the right course for everyone to save Israeli and Palestinian lives, and that there hasn't been a single documented case during this escalation of when Hamas has used civilian shields. So there's clearly a lot of work that we have to do.
And again, I'm speaking with Kate Gould, who's the Legislative Associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestine peace and has an article at the Huffington Post, Five Steps U.S. Can Take to Help Restore Israel-Gaza Ceasefire. And this latest war in Gaza is now in its 23rd day, which is the longest now between Israel and Gaza in terms of the 2008 conflict, which went on for 22 days, and the 2012 offensive that lasted for 8 days. Prime Minister Netanyahu said on Monday that it would be a prolonged campaign. Is there any sense on Capitol Hill that this just has to be stopped for the very least, for humanitarian reasons?
Certainly. There are members of Congress who are pushing for that, and most of them who are doing that, it's behind the scenes, it's quiet, but it's in their remarks to the administration. And I heard from an office today just before this resolution passed that seemed to blame Hamas for all the civilian casualties in Gaza, that I heard from an office that said, "Look, we understand that this is nonsense. This doesn't make any sense, and we agree with you that you know, and all the points that I raised." And they said, "But this is a really tough vote, and we're, you know, afraid that we're just going to get punished by the other side. That there's going to be just such a huge backlash in the district." And so we're still up against that kind of logic, twisted political logic, and we still have to show that there are a lot more people in the United States who want to see an end to this violence. So I think there are members of Congress pushing for an immediate ceasefire, and then there are those, we've seen Senator Mitch McConnell is actually saying we do not want a ceasefire, that there should be no ceasefire, that you know, he characterizes these ceasefire efforts led by Secretary Kerry as giving too much to Hamas and not enough to Israel, and you know, these sorts of preposterous claims. I mean, they do continue on Capitol Hill, and I'm sorry to say that those are often the loudest.
So that's when you say the other side, you're referring to the Republicans. Then they're more in support of Israel than there are at least some Democrats that are calling for a ceasefire.
The members of Congress who have called for a ceasefire, I think that's right, that all of them that I've seen are Democrats. But I would say, I mean, this is certainly not a you know, an issue that is just, you know, divided among the parties. I mean, we've seen Democratic and Republican members of really all political stripes come out in support of Israel's continuing attacks. So on Gaza. So I think and just a handful that have said we want an end to violence on all sides, and we condemn the killing on all sides, and even a few who have pushed for lifting the blockade on Gaza.
Well, when the head of the United Nations comes out to condemn the shelling of civilians who had crowded in this UN-run school, I'm assuming that it was a sanctuary of some kind. So when Ban Ki-moon calls this attack, "I condemn this attack in the strongest possible terms. It is outrageous, it is unjustifiable, and it demands accountability and justice. Nothing is more shameful than attacking sleeping children." That's pretty strong stuff, right? Is that resonating on Capitol Hill? In other words, that the head of the United Nations is upset and most of the European countries are upset by this?
Yes, I think that is starting to make its way on the Hill. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of skepticism about the United Nations, particularly when it comes to Israel-related issues on Capitol Hill. But it is a very important statement, and it shows just how we do have a lot of work to do on the Hill in terms of correcting these misperceptions about the United Nations. And I would just add, yeah, I mean, the shelters, the UN schools have been the places where Gazans have sought refuge. And when I was in Gaza, I stayed with a family, and I was just talking to them the other day. They live in Rafah, and the father there, he is working for UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. He's working at one of the schools in Rafah, and they are just terrified that their school will be next. I mean, they, you know, the UNRWA spokesperson had said that they gave the Israelis the coordinates for their school 17 times. I mean, there is a real concern that these schools are being targeted, and I mean we know that there's no safe place in Gaza, but that it seems like increasingly there's more and more attacks on the schools, on the hospitals, on the mosques, and these other places where civilians are gathered and trying to escape the violence.
But nevertheless, apparently the Hamas managed to fire more than 50 missiles at Israel on Wednesday. So they continue to fire missiles, which is ostensibly the reason why, at least that's the justification that Israel is using to attack Gaza and take out these tunnels through which fighters are infiltrated into Israel.
Right.
What's your sense of the claims that the Hamas fighters use or get as close as possible to these UN schools and these safe zones where civilians are crowding, expecting to be protected in order to, you know, invite retaliation, which is the charge that Israel is making?
So there's a couple of different issues here. So first, the legal definition of using a human shield means to actually force civilians to stay in areas that are under attack, to coerce them and then to use that to try to protect the combatants. So this has been, you know, the New York Times has reported, this has been reported by the BBC, many others have said, look, we haven't found any evidence. I mean, Israel's not presented any evidence, it's not publicly, that Hamas or other Palestinian militant groups are using civilian shields or human shields in this conflict. Now, the other issue you raised, though, very, you know, an important one, about Hamas launching rockets from residential areas. Yes, that is certainly true. Hamas is launching rockets from residential areas, and other Palestinian militant groups are doing that too, and they're launching rockets into Israel that have killed Israelis, and they're indiscriminate. They're not you don't know where they're going to land, but certainly all of them have an intent to kill, and they could kill, and it's a war crime of course. So that needs to be stopped, and we've seen that the Israel's bombardment of Gaza, whenever this happens, that there's only an increase in these attacks, in these rocket attacks into Israel. The best way to stop the rocket attacks is to negotiate a ceasefire. The optimum way that we've seen over these last few years of when rocket attacks have been at their lowest rate has been after the 2012 November 2012 ceasefire agreement was negotiated by Israel and Hamas. It was brokered by the Egyptian government at the time, and so with that agreement, the stipulation. One of the stipulations for Israel was that it would require Israel to lift the blockade or make, you know, substantial progress toward opening the borders of Gaza, and that was not done. And in fact, the blockade tightened, and it's gotten even worse in the last few days, in the last few weeks. And we're seeing people, you know, can't get medicine, can't get basic medical supplies into Gaza at this really terrifying time. So the blockade has empowered these extremist groups, Islamic Jihad, extremist groups more extreme than Hamas. Hamas is willing to negotiate with Israel. They have negotiated with Israel, mostly indirectly, you know, through these prisoner swaps and ceasefire agreements in the past. But this kind of attack, it really bolsters the support for the extremist groups that are opposed to any kind of negotiations with Israel. It's increasing the instability for Israelis. It's not providing anyone security. When these kids are killed in their sleep, this doesn't help anyone.
So just in closing then, Kate Gould, since you're with a Quaker lobby on Capitol Hill, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Are there religious figures on Capitol Hill speaking out just in terms of religion? Because most religions do not sanction murder, let alone the murder of children.
Certainly. Yes, there are a number of faith groups that are very active on this. And, of course, I mean, faith groups that have people in the region. I mean, we've seen there's a Catholic church that's been called, Israel told them to evacuate in Gaza. So the faith groups are watching this very closely, both for connections in the region, but more so because of the moral imperative for faith leaders to speak out against this horror. And they have been. We actually, FCNL was one of 11 organizations, faith-based organizations, to sign onto a letter to the president saying enough with all this violence. We need a ceasefire. We need to lift the blockade. And we need to look at the underlying factors that contribute to this violence, to the resumption of the violence, to this, we need to end the military occupation. And that the U.S. has a particular responsibility to do this because it's the U.S. that is sending those weapons that are being used to kill men, women, and children right now. It's the U.S. that's providing Israel the most military aid, and so it's the U.S. that can indeed push for a ceasefire, a durable ceasefire. And I would note also that this letter was sent to the president, and it was also picked up on NPR's On Point radio station during an interview with Secretary Clinton. She was asked about this letter as a Methodist, because the United Methodists signed onto it, American Friends Service Committee, a number of other groups, and she was asked, as a Methodist, would you agree with their point that we have to look at these underlying causes of the violence? We have to look at, you know, lifting the blockade and ending the military occupation. And unfortunately, you know, she did say that the groups have a point, but then she dodged the question a bit and went on to blame Hamas for the the violence. But
Kate, I'm afraid I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we've run out of time here. But
well,
I appreciate what you're trying to do there on Capitol Hill to bring about peace between Israel and Palestine. And thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Kate Gould, who's a legislative associate for Middle East Policy for the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a Quaker lobby in the public interest, fielding the largest team of registered peace lobbyists in Washington, D.C. She lobbies on Iran and Israel-Palestine peace and has an article at the Huffington Post, 5 Steps U.S. Can Take to Help Restore Israel-Gaza Ceasefire. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about Texas Governor Rick Perry and Junior Senator Ted Cruz posturing for the presidency.
Sister or a brother, it could be said. cosmopolitan town.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Wayne Slater, the senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, a position he was appointed to after 15 years as Austin bureau chief. He is co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential, and he has covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administrations of Texas governors Bill Clemens, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, and Rick Perry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wayne Slater.
Great to be with you, Ian, as always.
And, Wayne, Senator Ted Cruz is interfering with the House. He's done this before.
He's assisting with the House.
Right, but it doesn't make Boehner feel very good to have a senator come in and caucus with his members to basically make Boehner look ridiculous. I mean, you know, he's got Jeff Sessions and all these other guys trying to scuttle Boehner's compromise bill on the border.
That's right. And you know, Boehner has a problem, and his problem is within the Republican electorate in his own House, where there is a division between those folks, let's call them quasi-establishmentarian Republicans, and then those really strong Tea Party advocates who are making life miserable for John Boehner. And here is Ted Cruz, a member of the Senate, not only a member of the Senate, but a freshman, audaciously stepping over and trying to whip action in the U.S. House against the immigration proposal, in this case, that John Boehner wants. He's not helpful, and in fact, some of Boehner's allies are quite angry at Ted Cruz for his actions as an interloper in this regard.
But the clock is ticking on the House. They're all going on vacation on Friday. So this is obviously adding extra pressure to it. But Ted Cruz, of course, did a faux filibuster a while back, which a lot of commentators thought looked more like a fundraising operation. So how much is Ted Cruz grandstanding here for his presidential race? And it's also pretty clear that Governor Rick Perry is also grandstanding for a presidential race with his actions on the border, because as far as I know, these children crossing from Central America are coming in at the very same spot, and they're all looking for somebody to surrender to. So the idea that you're putting more military guys on the border at a cost of, what, $12 million a month seems like an expensive stunt.
Well, what you have here in the case of what's going on in the House is an effort to deal with the immigration, the House and Senate, an effort to deal with the immigration issue, or more precisely, an effort not to deal with it. And so that's a legislative matter fraught with politics that's going on in Washington. What you have with Rick Perry and Ted Cruz is something quite different, and that's 2016 presidential politics. Rick Perry and Ted Cruz are both competing for many of the same voters in the early caucus state, Republican caucus state of Iowa, and the primary state of South Carolina in northern Florida. And these are Christian conservative voters who are very strong on issues like immigration. And so when Rick Perry announced last week that he was going to send 1,000 National Guardsmen on his own to the Texas border, it was, as a practical matter, fairly ineffective. Those guardsmen are military. They are not police. They are not law enforcement. They don't have the authority to stop or interview or arrest anyone coming across the border, frankly. And certainly, you're right, they have the authority to shoot the children, but they don't have the authority to ask for their papers. Now, nobody's going to shoot any children. We know that. And that's because these children are, as you said, turning themselves in the moment that they come across the border. So as a practical matter, it's not very effective. But politically, Rick Perry returns to Iowa next month with Ted Cruz. I'll be there. And at a couple of events there, I anticipate that the governor of Texas will talk about how he, when the president failed, when the federal government did not do what it needed to do on the border, that he, the governor of Texas, took action. He sent the military to the border, and I anticipate that's going to be a big, big attack line. What can Ted Cruz say? He can say, I pressed the recalcitrant House. Now, again, that's John Boehner, the sort of force of establishmentarian politics, when Ted Cruz talks to the right and says, I forced or attempted to force them to a harder stand on immigration. It's who's tougher on immigration between Rick Perry and Ted Cruz. It has very little to do with solving a problem as a practical matter. It has a lot to do with 2016 presidential politics.
Well, specifically what Ted Cruz said on Wednesday is the only way to stop the border crisis is to stop Obama's amnesty. It is disappointing the border security legislation unveiled today does not include language to end Obama's amnesty. Congress cannot hope to solve this problem without addressing the fundamental cause of it. And, of course, amnesty is a wonderfully charged word, but entirely made up in this context.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the word. That's what you've got to say. Anyone who suggests any kind of middle ground, any consensus, any move toward consensus or agreement, if the moment that happens, you accuse them of amnesty. Now, the problem with many of the folks in the past on the far right who've charged that anything in any direction other than putting up two or three walls and putting our military on the border is amnesty is that the Republican Party finds itself in a curious situation. On the one hand, the strong conservatives want to look tough on the border, but they don't want to look mean on the border. And so here come these children from South America who arrive, and how can one look tough on the border? I want to secure the border, but not look mean in a way that we have seen here in Texas. Conservative Baptist ministers and their congregations, clergy of all sorts, liberals as well as conservatives finding themselves, because it's a recognition that these are God's children, somewhat wanting to talk about dealing with these children in a different way. What Cruz is trying to do is say, I'm going to be tough on the border. But at the same time, the way I want to do this is to end amnesty, whatever that means. And that will end this business of exploiting these children. If you hear that, you recognize that Cruz is on the one hand saying, I want to get rid of the folks who are here. I want, including many of the dreamers, the children who came here as the children of undocumented immigrants in the country. But what I'm really trying to do in the name of not meanness but compassion is end the pipeline of the coyotes and the others exploiting these children by ending the idea of amnesty. It doesn't make a lot of sense, but in a place like Iowa and South Carolina and the early presidential states, it is something that will have enormous appeal.
But it does seem that Senator Cruz has got two strong allies in the House, both from Texas, Representative Louie Gohmert and Pete Sessions,
as well.
And Sessions is also opposing the Boehner plan on the border. Now, Sessions is also leading the charge on trying to sue Obama, which is being voted on Wednesday in the House. Obviously, it's short of impeachment, and the White House is more or less signaling, like Dirty Harry, go ahead and make my day and impeach me. But this is a lawsuit. Now, Congressman Pete Sessions, apparently he is the fellow that told Obama to his face that he couldn't stand to look at him. So his hatred of Obama seems to be quite real, if not, you know, toxic.
I think it is real, and I think more importantly, it reflects the kind of visceral dislike of the president, not simply of his policies, but a kind of dislike of this president that has grown up and is endemic in many, many very conservative voters, many of them in southern states, but not only in southern states. And so when Congressman Sessions talks about Obama as in support of a lawsuit, and others like Louie Gohmert talk about the idea of impeachment, it is a dog whistle to voters who not only disagree with the president and the administration on issues, but have long-standing, rational, or in some cases, irrational attitudes about whether Obama should even be president, whether he really was from here. And so Sessions and others in the House, who, as I said earlier, caused John Boehner real heartburn by representing a strong, very strong Tea Party opposition within the GOP, are really reflecting an attitude by a lot of voters who don't like Obama and frankly, are causing problems for, as we say in Texas, for folks who don't understand that the Republican Party, in fighting itself, is damaging itself, in appearing harsh in dealing with a growing constituency like Hispanics, is damaging its prospects for the future. As we say in Texas, I can explain it to you, but I can't understand it for you. Many people on the Republican right have said, I'm trying to explain to you that some of these policies are not helpful for the future of the party, but you don't seem to want to understand it.
So, Wayne Slater, you were saying earlier that you're going up to Iowa to report on both Ted Cruz's presidential dipping his toe in the water and the same with Rick Perry. Rand Paul is now campaigning in Iowa, and so will Jeb Bush be after him. So they're all sort of heading that way. But I'm trying to get a handle on these two Texans, one the Senate and one the governor. We're told that Senator Cruz is extremely intelligent. So if he's taking these extreme stands, is he doing this purely for tactical reasons and that he doesn't necessarily believe what he's doing? Because a lot of the stuff is just headline grabbing and pretty extreme. And it's one thing to win the nomination, but it's another thing to have a chance at being president. So your team seem to first of all, there seems to be a real contrast between these two guys. One, Cruz is an intelligent guy who appears to be incredibly cynical, and the other guy seems to be less than intelligent. His performance in the Republican debates was beyond embarrassment. So why does he think he's got a chance on the national stage?
Both of these men, both Rick Perry and Ted Cruz, because I've spent a lot of time with both of them, clearly think they have a chance to be the Republican nominee, and like a lot of politicians, they think that makes it a very good chance that they could be president. And the reason that they think they could be the nominee is because they think they can appeal to a cluster of constituencies within the Republican Party, like-minded in large part constituencies within the Republican Party in these early caucuses and primaries, who are going to have a big say in who the nominee is. In the case of Ted Cruz, I would never say that he doesn't believe what he's talking about. I've been around him so much, and I know about him growing up in Houston, where even as a young kid in high school, he had very strong conservative views. But at the same time, he has a gift for and a recognition of the power of the audacious act of saying something and doing something, recognizing that I'm not going to make friends in Washington, but this is a way to build the political support within various voter groups for the future, meaning the White House. The key for Perry and Cruz is to understand that each thinks that the only way they can be the nominee, either one of them, is if the party, the Republican Party, does what it has not done recently, and that is to go to the right and name what and nominate what they believe will be a nominee who is principled in the way that they say Ronald Reagan was. You've heard this argument in many, many times. Instead of going to, quote, the middle, with a Bob Dole or a McCain or a Romney, that they would go to the right. The problem is that what has always happened in these presidential primaries and early caucuses is that the right, the Christian right, the Tea Party right, the Libertarian right, split and divide. And so there's not a single person who emerges as the candidate of both the Christian right and somewhat the Tea Party right, for whom some of these issues, social conservative issues, are also the same. And so each wants to build this group a group of Christian conservative voters. That's why both of them are talking about Israel. Also, of economic conservative voters. That's why Perry likes to talk about jobs. If one or the other can emerge, they believe, as the one person, as an alternative to, say, a Jeb Bush, Chris Christie, or someone else in the Republican Party, then they believe if the party doesn't splinter in the 2016 primary season, that either one of these can be the party of, quote, the true conservative voters in 2016. Now, where that leaves you for the White House and the general election is another matter.
Well, of course, in Iowa at the moment, the person who's ahead in the polls is Mike Huckabee. That's because the Iowan caucus voters are, you know, dominated by the Christian conservatives. But when these guys talk about Ronald Reagan, I think they forget that there was such a person as Nancy Reagan, and that in many ways Reagan may be pandered to the Christian right. But in general, Nancy and he were fairly liberal, at least in their personal life. And his legislation wasn't as right-wing as any of these guys.
Right. I mean, you're right, and you're offering nuance, and frankly, luckily, unluckily, much of the political debate is unencumbered by actual nuance, knowledge, and information, I think, very often. Politics, especially the politics of people like Rick Perry and Ted Cruz, and frankly, not Rand Paul, actually, but some of the others in the game, politics is a bumper sticker sport. The bumper sticker beats the position paper almost every time, and Perry and Cruz are playing bumper sticker politics. You yell the word amnesty, you say something like Obama, you should be impeached, and that's what grabs the headlines, and that what galvanizes a constituency around you.
Well, just in closing, Wayne Slater, I have a real hunch that Rand Paul is going to be the runaway winner here, because he is organizing a vast base. He is going after African-American voters. He's on the campuses. He's up in Silicon Valley getting all that libertarian money. I think he's a formidable force. I think these other guys, they're too short-sighted. They're pandering to the first hurdles, but it'll diminish their chances of getting to the big hurdles at the end of the race.
Some of Paul's libertarian views various libertarian views are clearly an obstacle for him. I've spent some time with Rand Paul. He is an extraordinary person. Obviously, he grew up with a father who had his own special sense of the world, but he is an extraordinarily deep and interesting person with a political view. I think that very well can happen, but if he's tripped up by Christian conservatives and other Republicans who can't bear and can't go along with some of his libertarian ideas, then you wonder where the party goes and whether it goes to someone more conventional like a Jeb Bush, which I have increasing doubts about, or whether someone like Indiana's Mike Pence emerges at some point and becomes the fresh new face of the Republican Party. But yeah, you ought to keep an eye, we all ought to keep an eye on Rand Paul.
Well, Wayne Slater, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Great to be with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Wayne Slater, who's a senior political writer for the Dallas Morning News, a position he was appointed to after 15 years as the Austin Bureau Chief. He is co-author with James Moore of the New York Times bestseller Bush's Brain, How Karl Rove Made George W. Bush Presidential. And he has covered every Republican and Democratic National Convention since 1988 and the administrations of Texas Governor Bill Clements, Ann Richards, George W. Bush, and Rick Perry. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.